Hello and welcome to Raising Anchor, your podcast and source for all things Rhode Island FC. I'm your host, Matt Intrican, coming to you on this Thursday, February 27th. RIFC wraps up their remaining time in Bermuda with some lessons learned and some questions remaining. We're going to cover the results between the Hearts of Pine as well as the Bermuda Select team before deep diving into the biggest storylines of the year ahead for the Boys and Amber and Blue. And to do all that and so much more is the one and only Jason Carey. Jason, how is it going, my friend?
Not too bad, all things considered. There's maybe some concerning Oneyville news that's been going around.
Concerning, it's tragic.
Yeah.
Dark times ahead.
I say concerning because I'm always one to give someone the benefit of the doubt. If they say they're going to try and continue it on as the same it's always been, I'll give them a shot. But I just also don't have that much faith in that form of capitalism where you know, private equity comes up and buys mom and pop shops, and it's rarely ever the same. Like I said, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, but it's a wait and see.
Soccer wars move over. The wiener wars have begun. Hashtag not a hot wiener podcast. We'll talk about that in the mailbag a little later. People did ask us questions. And by the way, that rabbit trails, there's some deep conspiracy theories on what's exactly going on in the state of Rhode Island. But hey, terrible transitions aside, we're not alone tonight. As for the people watching along, we have a very special guest tonight. Joining us is the stupendous Liz McGowan, who covers Rhode Island FC with the Blazing Musket, amongst many other talents. Liz, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you guys for having me tonight. I'm excited to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. You know, it was so funny the first time that I had the chance to run into you. It was one of the times where you were just sitting in the scrum, and I just kind of looked over and I'm like, oh my gosh, someone's asking a competent question of the team, and like, who is this person? And then lo and behold, we worked for the same group technically, right, with the Blazing Musket. So always great to meet a fellow coworker out in the world. Liz, you know, you've done some tremendous writing for the Blazing Musket and have been kind of a pillar in building up what it means to be an expansion soccer side here in the greater New England area. I guess, you know, for people that don't know your work, there's a couple of authors, there's a couple of writers in the stable for the Musket. But can you give a little bit of background about who you are, your connection to soccer, and kind of your love for the game?
Yeah, of course. So first and foremost, like, I played soccer myself for 18 years, I believe. Probably as early as I can remember. First sport my parents tried to put me in just to get me out of the house was soccer. Fell in love immediately. My younger sister also played. We've been on the same teams a couple times. And I just always had like a passion for it, I guess. Like even playing collegiately, like at the higher level, my coach would come to me and say kind of like, oh, like some people just play it to play, but you're one of those people you can tell you know the game. You love the game, so we'd kind of have, like, strategy sessions and stuff. And I kind of figured that writing about the sport and getting it out there was for me right before college and high school. Wasn't really sure what I wanted to do post-high school and was really struggling. I knew I liked writing, and I knew I really enjoyed soccer. And I believe it was the 2018 World Cup, the U.S., didn't qualify, but I was sitting there watching the games on my couch at home, and I said, hey, why don't I do this? I can put the two things I love the most together. And I didn't really do anything with it until I got to college. Like, my degree is in sports broadcasting. One of my professors, I went to Dean College in Franklin, Massachusetts, just down the road. John Rook, who is big name and like
John Brook, the center back, right? U.S. men's national team legend. That John Brook, right?
close. New England Patriots, I think, legend. He's like the in-stadium voice for the team, and he does a lot in Rhode Island in general. And he kind of was a big help for me once I got to college with really honing in on what I wanted to do. He encouraged me to write a little bit for our college newspaper. So my first article was ahead of the Qatar World Cup. I wrote a little piece about Matt Turner. And I believe that was the first thing I wrote that was sent to like Sam and the guys at the Musket, and they really enjoyed that work. So they contacted me and kind of got me going with this. So,
no, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the Musket is, and by the way, it's like the third or fourth largest independent journalist Substack now. I think it's like just trailing Backheeled in terms of content and subscribers. But a lot of people don't realize that the Blazing Musket, in all the various variations it's had, it's just a collection of people who want to write and cover teams. I mean, I don't get paid. I mean, if Sam is paying you, Liz, like, tell us now, because we need to renegotiate our contract.
Yeah, no pay, just doing it for the love of the sport.
love of the game.
So I guess I would ask, you know, one of the things that always fascinates me is how people get assigned to the different markets, right? Like, there are, believe it or not, there are assigned, let's say, contributors that kind of have their team so that they can get more intimate knowledge. Everyone kind of follows the pulse of soccer in New England, but there's definitely beat writers. How did you get with Rhode Island FC? Did you just get like the shortest straw in the draw and like, hey, you got to go cover this championship club? You can't go to Gillette and cover the Revs? Or did you want to sign up for the Rhode Island FC gig?
So when I first talked to Sam and got like started with this, I was actually covering the Revs too at the time. And I believe like Rhode Island, it had just like the concept of it had just really gotten rolling. But I always knew like in the back of my mind that once this had like solidified, this was where I wanted to be, like this team, because as somebody who's lived in Rhode Island my whole life, like there was nothing more exciting than us getting our own professional team finally.
So you gave yourself a promotion, you know, you were already ahead of the pro rel system and you were like, hey, I'm moving up to Division II writing. I love it. I'm glad you touched on, you know, being from Rhode Island and this being important to you. What does it mean? You know, because sometimes we get asked that question a lot. We're not natives to the space and it always has a different understanding, a different meaning. But what does, as a lifelong passion fan, what does it mean to have a soccer club truly for this state?
So for me personally, my whole life, my dad and my uncle have had Revolution season tickets. So making that drive up there and just sitting in those stands every weekend was so much fun to me. But something about like, it's a team for New England, but you know, in Massachusetts, it never quite felt like this is for the little guys. And I think me personally, like I have a lot of family in Rhode Island throughout the various parts, like specifically Pawtucket is where I spent a lot of time growing up because I had a lot of family there. So to me, just seeing like the soccer roots in Pawtucket specifically and knowing it was just down the road from me, I think there was just something always in the back of my mind of like, if we could get something going here, I know it would mean a lot because this is, in my opinion, a very soccer loving state and like community in general.
Yeah, no, and we almost did it in year one, which is what we're here today to talk about. We're going to recap the 2024 season. This is kind of the kickoff. This is our preseason. We've moved from offseason to preseason. We're getting ready for the main event here. So we're going to run through kind of what happened at the end of 2024, because I think, Jason, some of this was lost, right? Like, we got so excited. We were knocking on that door of winning everything, and then that was the end story, right? We didn't really ever look back at what got us to that point.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it kind of was maybe also a gut punch when you get that far and you kind of feel like, all right, at this point it's just destiny, right? This is ours. Didn't even think that there was a possibility it wasn't going to happen. And then all of a sudden we're like, oh, okay. It's not even like not winning it too was almost a bit of like a humbling performance in a way. It's like, maybe we flew too close to the sun. We got burned there a little bit. It you know, it wasn't like, ah, it was close, right? We lost 2-1. I was like, no, it was, we were never really in that game.
Ways. And we're going to talk about that, right? So we're going to lead up to what got us to that USL Cup final. And then we're going to get everyone prepared for the 2025 season. I think we have a lot of interesting storylines and questions to ask amongst the three of us as we cover this team this season ahead and kind of look forward. But before we do that, we have a bunch of other things to cover. Some other stuff has happened around inside and outside of the club. So we want to get through those things before we get to the recap. So lightning fast here on these quick hits. One, RIFC is announcing its first ever RIFC Classic. It's going to be a 5-versus-5 tournament for soccer of all ages, and it's going to be held on April 26th. I think the like youngest you can be is about 7 years old, and then you can play all the way up to an adult. The adult league is just like 18 and up, so you could have like 65-year-old Portuguese guys going out there taking on like 19-year-old college. But I'd love to see it. Right now, the registration costs only $500. Fans everywhere on like Facebook groups, on Reddit, they're super excited this is coming. From what I'm being told also, by the way, because I never played like in a professional soccer tournament or anything like that, I'm being told this is a bargain when you talk about like tournament costs. So, Jason, do we need to sponsor a Raising Anchor team, or are you going to finally lace up the boots and show Kana what you got?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm trying to work off that winter weight there, trying to get back in shape. I mean, it is 2 months away. I don't know if I can get anything more than maybe a sub roll.
Liz, you know, I heard you say retired player, 18 years. Are you booting up for this?
I mean, I'm always itching for an opportunity to get back on the field, if I'm being honest.
What position were you?
I was center back and outside back towards the end. So a little bit of everything in the back line.
All right. Find yourself four other players. I think one of them has to be a keeper and three others and you're set. So I love to see it. I can't wait to see how big this can become. I think this can be a really big moment for the soccer community, not just the professional side. And I'm super excited. I think we got another quick hit here about the stands and some news there.
Yeah. So a bit of change is coming to the supporter section in a good way. So the front office and Defiant 1636 have worked together to have some of the seating there changed. So 116 behind the south end is going to continue to be the standing only. However, the two sides next to it, which is also kind of an extension of that supporters group, sections 115 and 117, will have seats available for fans. Meaning that if you are almost in that deep end, you're like, I am really passionate, but maybe I need to sit down sometimes. You can be right there next to them, cheer, hang out, have a great time, but also kind of get that seating there.
Yeah, it's a great move by the club. I mean, you know, there are multiple people who can't stand for 90 minutes. There's families when you think about that involvement. I think this is just a great way to continue the buildup of the area. You know, it's interesting that lower bowl, that south side, minus the supporter group sections, all of that's now sold out completely, right? Because that's some of the cheapest tickets in the stadium, plus it's the field level adjacency. So you're not, you know, some people like being up top, some people like being, you know, right where the action is. So I think this is a great way. I don't think anyone anticipated Defiance was going to sell three sections in the second year. Like, they did a good job of going from 35 people at like the first preseason game to filling out their section at Burn. But I think maybe, you know, you look at like what the appetite, like that's a, it's great that they have it. They can grow it, but I think this was the right move. I want to say just one kind of thing about it. When you look at how that will work, if you already have tickets in those sections right now, we don't have the information yet on how, because those were kind of general admission. So you had like a seat number that you bought, but like it was kind of free for all. The club and specifically the supporters group has said that they're going to honor the seat alignments. So like if that's the section you bought and that's what you want, they're going to work through making sure that that's kind of understood that those are your seats, but probably some more work needs to get done. I think of like the bigger clubs where it's GA and like people go in and lay just blankets and scarves and like they cover a whole row and then people get mad because it's like they don't walk in until the five minutes before the game starts and people have been there for an hour and they're chanting and hooting and hollering. So probably some stuff to get worked out there, but that's fantastic to see. And it's really exciting too, because next week on March 6th is when single tickets do go on sale. So I imagine that if those spots aren't filled up, because all those other sellouts, by the way, are season ticket members. So every single one of those seats is sold for every single game. I imagine that a lot of those single tickets, those are going to quickly go in those sections starting next week. So those fans that are curious for the hottest ticket in town, they may not realize what they're signing up for next to Defiance. Final thing, speaking of Defiance, we have one last update there to give you guys.
Yeah, and so a quick reminder here that Defiance 1636 is having their first meetup of the season to pick up membership scarves and welcome new members into the community. They'll meet up at the Guild in Pawtucket next Friday, March 7th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And then at FYI, their supporters kit is still available for pre-order, but time is limited on that as the ordering ends on March 14th. Once the window is closed, your chance is gone forever.
I love that they're making kits. You know, we got a lot of questions in the mailbag this week about kits. Liz, curious your thoughts, you know, non-team kits, supporter group kits. Is that a thing we should be leaning into, or is that off limits? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
So I personally, the ones that I've seen, I kind of love them sometimes. Like, I believe last year there was a collaboration with the musket, for like a musket inspired kit, and I still kind of kick myself for not picking up that one.
Does Sam know that one of his own contributors didn't buy the kit?
He might now, but I had my eyes on it, and then I got busy with other things, and when I went to finally buy it, the sale was over, and I was so upset.
See, let that be a PSA to everyone listening. Do not wait till the last minute. This is the kit here on the screen for those watching along on YouTube or on Twitter. I think it's clean. We talked about it last week in the mailbag. It gives me like Liga Amekis or like Boca vibes. Obviously, it's influenced by the president of Defiance. Jason and I, we've already worked out our plan for, we've got our kits locked in. So don't be a Liz, be more like Matt and Jason and go get your kits right now. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Liz, are you in agreement? You're going to get this kit instead?
I think I'm going to have to pick this one up.
Are you, by the way, are you going to be able to make it for the March 7th hangout at the Guild, or is that going to mess with your schedule? Because lots of people, by the way, they want to meet you. I don't know how, if you know this, you're rather famous in the Discord, being a positive force for spreading the gospel of RIFC.
I had no idea. I'm not going to lie. I just, you know, do my writing and hope people enjoy it.
So that wasn't a yes or no, everyone. So you're going to have to spam the messages in chat to convince her. Because if she has previous obligations, she's obviously going to have to cancel those now. Moving along though, final quick hit, stadium job fair, first version of it, first round complete. They had two different sessions this prior Monday, a very big event. It was on the news. Governor McKee was there in person, and we saw a lot of friends of supporters groups, as well as the podcast there applying for jobs. There was a fun video of Natesky, the legend himself, applying for a job, which I thought was interesting because I would figure he'd want to be at the front of the supporters group. So I'm curious what his thoughts are. We'll have to connect with him next week. But great to see.
Didn't a player get stuck outside behind the crowd trying to just go into the office or something?
I mean, it was great to see that many people. You could tell that there's a passion in it, and it follows up with Rhode Island FC's commitment to create jobs. And remember, some of these are not just RAFC jobs. These are stadium jobs. So in that planned purpose of having 100 vents a year, that's a lot more than just like, because I can see someone spinning it now like, oh, wow, you hired someone for 17, you know, 6-hour jobs, like whoop-de-doo, like don't brag about that. But this, if you know anything about event stadiums, like this is a full-time potential career for a lot of these people that went and applied.
Yeah, it's really awesome that they're doing this. Looking forward to seeing all the different events throughout the year.
So let's get into the bigger news here. And I want to start off with some alumni tracking. Last week, Morris Dugan started for Minnesota United in the MLS season opener against LAFC. Minnesota United went on to lose the game 1-0, but don't let Duggan's fought mob rating fool you. Don't let that scoreline fool you. That game was about as close as it could get. I was really impressed with that. I wasn't even planning to watch that game just because I have an internal hatred for LAFC. But if our boy Duggan's on the field, like you got to watch it. And so much so, don't take my word on Duggan's performance. We have the man himself, Coach Eric Ramsey's of Minnesota United. We have his own words. I went in and pulled the Minnesota communications tape. And here's what Coach Ramsey's had to say about Duggan.
Sure do.
Well, apparently it's not working, but I would tell you Coach Ramsey said a lot of nice things about Morris. Don't know why it's not coming up. Wait, here we go. Let's see if it loads again. No, it does not want to play. All right. Sorry, guys. You're going to have to just trust me on this. We'll post it as a social media bit like we did with the Duggan interview earlier this week. So anyways, I guess I want to ask you, Jason, the big comment we thought at the beginning of the year, we got to eat a little crow. I have to eat a little crow here. I was convinced Duggan was going to come back and join this team. not because he didn't deserve to play with Minnesota, but because of the talent being stacked on that back line, signing some young talent, some U22 initiatives, as well as some international depth. He couldn't penetrate the back. He couldn't penetrate the roster last year, which is what brought him to RIFC. So I just figured he'd wash back down and get some more time. That's not the case. He starts, has a tremendous performance. So much so, by the way, Duggan was the only player after the game to be interviewed by the pool reporters back in Minnesota. So like they didn't talk to any other player on the team. What do we think about this? Do we just want to congratulate Duggan here, or is this something? Is there something else here that we like? Could we still see Duggan back in an amber and blue kit this season?
Wait, so he's not going to be back? I don't understand. in all seriousness, no. It is it is great to see him kind of make that jump. It is a great advertisement for the league too. In essence of being able to convince players who are maybe on the verge of kind of breaking into that lineup that. No, this is a competitive, viable option. And if you really, you know, are worth as much as maybe you think you are, you put the time in, you get that work at, you'll be able to showcase your abilities and then maybe take that back to the quote unquote MLS, you know, like better league to make that jump if that's your kind of career trajectory.
Liz, you've seen players come up and down from the Revs to the Revs. This is probably par for the course and how you followed the sport yourself. Anything surprising here to see Duggan go from a USL Cup final performance into the MLS season opener?
I mean, kind of like you guys, I think I was expecting him to come back to Rhode Island. He was one of our anchors back there for the second half, like towards the end of that season, since he arrived. And for me personally, that MLS opener, like I wasn't going to watch it because I'm not the biggest LAFC fan, but I saw Minnesota and I was like, oh, what the heck? I don't really follow them like that. I knew he went back there. So I think I turned it on just as it was like a close up of him. And I was like, oh, like, there we go. That's forgot about that. Might as well root. Like I was kind of getting some crap from my boyfriend. Cause he was like, oh, you don't want to root for Will Ferrell and LAFC.
Absolutely not.
No, that's my guy, Duggan. He was on my team last year. We want him to win.
We don't root for Will Ferrell, former LA Galaxy fan turned, you know, he gets some money, buys a soccer team, and you forget your roots. Absolutely not. You can say what you want, by the way, about Duggan. I think he was great. If there's an opportunity that we see him get loaned back down, I think it's highly unlikely. But anything is possible. There's a good relationship, a good working relationship with Minnesota. But when you look at what's being stacked on that back line and kind of the day-to-day questions of Ugo Bacharach, it looks like this may be something that we have to put in the dustbin for the time being. I will say this, though, final thoughts. I was literally told multiple times by Rhode Island FC that he was Morris Dugan. I said Morris Dugan to his face. I announced Morris Dugan at the stadium like, 7 times, 9 times, no one ever corrected me. And I always thought everyone else was wrong. The pundits, everyone else, Minnesota's own communication director introduced him as Morris Duggan. So
either, what if they're wrong?
I don't know who's wrong. I'm assuming it's me at this point, but like Morris, if you ever hear this, you got to correct people. You deserve to be called what you are and nothing less. So if I got that wrong, I apologize. And I'll have words with Rhode Island FC's front office in the near future. Moving along really quick, the other alumni news, Mark Doyle, as if Duggan wasn't enough speculation for the week, Doyle was staying or moving and going to Europe. We didn't know, and it's been found. The Irish attacker officially joins the USL One side of One Knox SC in Knoxville, Tennessee, under head coach Ian Fuller. Some questions here, guys. One Knox finished the 2024 season middle of the table in fifth, but they had the lowest goal production in the league at just 23 goals. Is Mark Doyle going to fix that, or is that a lot of pressure to put on the Irishman?
I mean, I think that is a decent amount of pressure. It's hard to say, though, because in the scale of comparing the Irish league to our leagues, like I don't know where they stack. I know they're definitely lower down there on the tier list. So, you know, is he going to be able to elevate their attack? I hope so. I feel like he was just kind of always just there or about with us. and that like if he would have just got one or two more goals for us, like it would have kind of unlocked, you know, opened the floodgates, so to say. You know, obviously we want a lot of all of our previous players to do well as long as they aren't playing against us. So, you know, that's five players now actually that left RFC that went to USL, right? One, sorry.
Correct.
So it is interesting to look at that and think, sure, maybe not all these players got a lot of minutes, but we did make it to the final. So would you think that maybe there's some more worth there potentially? Or did they just didn't get enough time? Because in his essence, compared to some of the other players, Doyle got a decent amount of playing time. So there's a better kind of, you know, highlight reel of what it is that he like can bring to a team compared to maybe some of these other teams. So I would have thought that maybe somewhere in the USL championship, someone would have picked him up. But I guess we just don't know the other side too. We don't know what it is that Doyle was looking for. And maybe he was not getting the right offers.
Warm weather, probably mostly. Liz, is Doyle, I mean, you covered him, you watched him. Is Doyle the product of someone who just got unlucky, but is of championship caliber and will have to kind of fight his way back up in the USL One side? Or do you think USL One is perfectly positioned and paced for his type of gameplay to make a positive contribution to One Knox this season?
So I'm kind of in the same boat again of thinking like he in the beginning, like I think he scored, like I know he had a couple goals for us, but
hey, he scored that opening goal against New Mexico.
Yeah, we count that.
Forever giving him that own goal.
Yes. But I think like I agree, if he had just scored a couple more, like opened the floodgates and had that moment. Like me personally, towards the end of the second half of the season, when we saw like JJ Williams start to break out, Noah Fuson started doing a little bit more, he kind of faded for me, honestly. So I think if he does just put in that extra little grind, he could get back to that higher competing level.
I think that tracks. A lot of fans were a little shocked by this, not because the caliber isn't there, but just because of the fact that, you know, he felt like the right fit. And we'll talk a little bit about the contributions here in a minute, but it's good to see him land on his feet. If that's what he wanted to do, that's exciting. If this is just more of a, he needed to find a space to land, like sometimes you take the job you get, not the job you want, and that's where it goes. But moving into the final piece before we start this recap, we did get the theme. The theme nights were finally announced ahead of the individual ticket sales starting next week. So we have a lot of different themes all together, but the big ones that you can see here on the screen, and I won't go over all of them, that the team has posted all of that stuff. So anyone that's following this, I imagine you're also following for the club. I would hope you're following the club, but I do want to talk about the actual giveaways and the nights that have more than just kind of like a theme topic or a title to them. So first and foremost, of course, May 3rd, the inaugural game, it's going to be historic, right? It's Rhode Island FC taking the keys, debuting in their new stadium. And plus, of course, they're going to celebrate the Eastern Conference Championship. They're going to raise a big banner. And also, by the way, and I don't know the numbers on this, but there's giveaways this year. So we're having some giveaways attached, and they got ahead of this and kind of launched them early, but there's going to be a captain's pennant. So like one of those, I've always called them baseball pennants. I've never heard of it as a captain's pennant, but there's going to be a pennant given away to celebrate either the Eastern Conference Championship or just the season itself. But there's going to be an RFC captain's pennant. Moving ahead to 5/10 Youth Soccer Day, this is going to be the first of a few of the $1 hot dog, $2 drinks, and $4 beer giveaways, or not giveaways, but nights. And then in addition to that, on that youth soccer night, there will be a beanie that's going to be given away courtesy of Centauro Oil. Moving ahead to June 7th, that's Amber Night. Channel your inner road warrior. I guess we're going to be making sure we wear the Amber kits to a home match that time around. And there's going to be $5 RIFC Amber Pale Ales, but there's also going to be a giveaway of an Amber t-shirt. So lots of yellow, lots of Amber that night. Moving on to June 14th, that's going to be the new 401 night because we couldn't have one actually in April this season with the stadium coming in late. That's going to be another one of those hot dog nights. And then this is where it gets interesting. 6/21 school's out. That's going to be the first of three fireworks shows. So if you remember from general manager Paul Byrne, he mentioned how much he really loves that when a stadium puts on like the fireworks, the like singing the of the national anthem
kind of event.
Yeah, he's really big onto those kinds of things. So that's going to be the first of three of those. Of course, we're going to have El Clamico, which, by the way, we need to talk about that for a second because I think this is important. Earlier this week, a Hartford fan asked, what are we calling the Hartford Rhode Island Derby on Reddit? And I knew that there was some contention there amongst the two fan bases that, you know, some of us wanted one thing, some of us wanted another, and there hadn't really been a meeting of the minds, and it didn't look like the fan bases had really come together on anything just yet. But you've heard us say El Clamico, you've heard the pundits, I heard Mike Watts say it on All Access earlier last week. And so in my mind, it's El Clamico, but like it has to be done by the fans. That Reddit post had Hartford fans and Rhode Island FC fans coming together, joining forces and agreeing on El Clamico. Liz, Jason, I think it's El Clamico. How do we feel, like officially, how do we feel about that?
Yeah, I think at this point, considering I went back and checked that out because I was like, oh, wait, really? And then, yeah, it was just tons of people saying El Clamico. There's like a decent minority of the whole like Route 6 thing, but I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of the whole, you know, highway freeway based kind of derby names, but I don't know, to each their own.
Liz, what do you think?
I think there was a point last season when a very popular one I kept seeing was that El Trashico. So I think anything's better than that.
That was the haters.
That's the same person that said the derby should be named Kiss Your Sister, and they didn't know what they were talking about. So are you okay with El Clamico then instead?
Yes, very.
So I think we may have it then. And this came from a fan. I need to go back into the Discord chat, and someone needs to go down in like RIFC lore because that's how they deserve it. You know, like that's how that should go. But moving back into the final parts of the theme nights to cover here, you've got 8/6 Wicked Good Weeknight, another value deal with beers, drinks, and hot dogs. And then you have 8/9, which is called Folklore Night. Listen, the management of this club is leaning heavily into Taylor Swift tendencies here. They're calling it the Stadium Era Tour. They're calling it the next great American dynasty. They're talking about dying Chip Key Lime Green in the most recent promo video. They're leaning in heavily. Now, if Taylor Swift is going to be at this, they just need to come out and say it, and they need to like start selling out the stadium immediately. I think they're just going to play her albums on repeat for a while. But like, could you imagine T Swift coming to Tidewater?
I was really confused when I saw this as someone who pays no attention to Miss T Swizzle. I was like, Folklore Night, like, are we like having like celebrating Cthulhu or something, or like what are we do? Or like
only you would
folk
think
music
HP Lovecraft when you hear folklore. I love it.
You know, I just didn't, you know, folk metal bands are gonna play at halftime. Like I didn't know what was going on here.
I wish this hadn't dropped earlier today because I challenged all three of us to name the most Taylor Swift songs. I think Liz, you just need to know three, and I know you got me beat. And Jason, I don't think knows one.
A couple years ago, I worked security at Gillette, so all three nights of her concerts I had to work Barricade, so that was an experience for sure.
Didn't sound positive there. It sounded like that's like a form of PTSD when she hears the Swift on the mic. Listen,
are T-Swizzle fans really that rabid?
Oh,
there was a few pretty intense ones on like right first row. So a lot of nice people, but some people were just like watching something else.
No, you could never pay me enough. I thought it was gonna be for the Folk Festival. Obviously, that's deeply enrooted into the community, into the state. Folk Fest is much earlier in July, so I was like, wait, what are these lineups? And then I realized, oh no, this is basically called what it is. It's Taylor Swift night. So hey, if it gets people out, more power. Can you, like, if you've never seen a concert, by the way, Jason, they dress up, they go all out. So we could have some incredible fan attire on. We may need to think of Taylor Swift outfits for this specific game. We'll get
somehow
into it
tied
later.
In with RFC gear as well.
You know I love a good custom outfit. So and then wrapping things up, 10-5, we have Student Rush, the final one of the discount nights, and then finally also Fan Appreciate Night, the very last game of the season. They're going to do a lot of different giveaways, a lot of different freebies. They will give out another team poster at the end of that, so that'll kind of be the offering there. I don't think there's like else that needs to be said. These are a lot of these are kid like orientated, you know, and it's important to bring the families, the people looking for an event to go do.
Yeah, and speaking of families, when you look at a lot of the details of some of these, we have $4 hot dog nights. That's huge, right? So if the tickets maybe around $20, you can spend a dollar or two extra per kid to kind of feed them, and kind of it really helps with families budgeting for those expenses. Because it's one thing to say, okay, well, I got to get them this $15-$20 ticket, and then they're gonna want like a $15 meal or something, but dollar hot dog, here you go.
I think that's the day when inflation really hits us, is when hot dogs can no longer be a dollar. I think that's going to be the scariest timeline for us. So, Liz, any final thoughts on the theme nights? I mean, we can't really compare it to anything else in the space. It's not fair to compare it to a more resource, you know, provided place like the Revolution. And it's never fair to compare ourselves to Hartford Athletic. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think the only thing really being that I didn't fully realize it was a Taylor Swift night either until I was going over the notes for today's show. Like, I think I was the same boat. I thought it was like music related, or like not her, but I don't know. I missed the heart hand emoji too.
I think legally they can't say Taylor Swift, otherwise they get in trouble. So they get in trouble. All right, well then let's get into the real stuff. Let's talk about soccer again. We're back on track. Jason, let's get caught up in this most recent. Well, the most recent game is we just are going through it right now. So let's talk about the game that happened earlier this week.
Yeah, so played up against here against Hearts of Pine, final time, 0-0. I guess I would say it was not necessarily expected. But when we look at preseason, in some ways, maybe doesn't mean too much. You also have that, you know, circumstance where maybe winning every game could have kind of be bad for expectations wise, right? You want the team to have some sort of struggle so that coach can have something specific to look into, to work on and say, okay, we couldn't score this game. Why is that? Let's break this down. Let's look at our attack. Is there something missing? Are there certain defensive patterns that we couldn't break down? Are there some deficiencies on our own side that didn't allow us to perform up to our high standards that night? So I, you know, obviously don't want them to lose or even watch all of the preseason games to lose, but I think not winning every single one can be good.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't know a lot about what happened outside of some of the photos that were provided by Hearts of Pines media group. And then, of course, you know, what our own club showed us. But I do want to kind of unpack some of the what looked like experimentation on Kano's side, at least with that starting 11 photo that they took. You know, we're going to assume Kano lives by the 3-5-2 as his ride or die until he doesn't have the players or those tactics have kind of evolved and that, you know, that becomes yesterday's news. So when you look at the players that were available, that leaves Koke obviously in net. And then you had, in some sort of combination, Nodarse, Yao, and Okiyoshi. And because I didn't see Stoneman, we know that Ugo is on the mend. So from a backline perspective, that kind of automatically puts Nodarse into the backline, unless Cole, the new signing of Cole Dewhurst, steps into that space. But Cole was not in the starting 11, which then leads me to believe that the mid five was a combination of Fuson in that right wing back, which we've seen him be experimented not just in the playoffs last season, but also in this preseason. We've seen some of that experimentation. And then it was Holstead, Brito, Ibarra, and Sanchez in that kind of five line. Maxi Rodriguez was also in the squad. And then the only other player left was JJ Williams. So I kind of want to ask you, and Liz as well, we know that with Kano, formations are fluid. We know that, you know, it's a starting position on the field, and then the tactics change. They morph into the needs of the game. I think, though, the question has always been at that right wing back position. When we lost Turnbull, we assumed that Nodarce was first the next step into it. But then when we signed Danny Rivera, we saw that he could play both left or right. Then we also saw when we signed, Aldair Sanchez, that made more sense for Danny Rivera to play on that right wing back side. But then, of course, now there's also Noah Fusson, who we've seen drift into that when you needed a maximum level of attacking threat on the field. We know that Clay Holstead can also drop back and kind of do that in an emergency pinch. But I guess the question is like, when we saw Fusson go into the right wing back role, we always assumed it was coming out of a need to get Chico on the pitch. Chico definitely did not play, at least in the initial minutes in this, which tells me, did Rodriguez move higher up the pitch to fill in the gap here? Or did we actually change formations and like strand JJ Williams up top? Or do we have this all wrong and maybe Holstead or Brito played in a position that like we're not aware of? Like, what are your guys' thoughts on that? And is this the right experimentation to be going with when we're this close to the start of the season?
I mean, first thought, when I look at the potential lineup here that you have, the one thing I would challenge, just knowing what we've seen in the past, is that maybe Nodarce was actually the left center back, Holstad was right center back, and Okiyoshi was actually in midfield. At the end of the day, these are just the starting positions. It's more about the individual tactics of each position and what they're asked to do in the different like possessions of play, like how this means anything. So, and it, especially if we've seen Holstead kind of drift more to that right side to kind of help cover the center back, fullback kind of position. And maybe you have Fusson kind of push up to kind of hang out with Williams and Rodriguez. Like, there's a lot of shifting, especially if we, and I don't know if the stats I imagine weren't released from this game, if we dominate possession, well, then you would have seen Koke in the back with two center backs kind of spread out wide. And that means that third center back, whoever they would be pushing up into the midfield. And, you know, like I said, it's just a starting kind of position. In a way, we've almost inverted the pyramid again after all these years where it, you know, you have that, and we're pushing so many people forward and the only person back is Koke.
Liz, does that make sense? Does that track for you? I mean, is this a place where, you know, I think of the versatility of Clay, and I feel like he's wasted if he plays a deeper role. But then if he's not playing the deeper role, it does seem to isolate someone on that front line. What are your thoughts on Coach, you know, trying these players in different positions on the pitch?
I honestly think, like, if we are going to experiment with where we're putting these people, trying new things, that preseason is like the perfect time to try it. Like, I know we're getting close to the start of the actual season, so some people might think we need to like nail down what we actually want to do, but I'm a firm believer that trial and error, just experimenting in the preseason, do it now while it doesn't really matter as much, just so we can like work out those kinks and really nail down some alternatives or like other ways that we might need to play going into the actual season.
You know, I mentioned that there were lessons from any game, especially in the preseason. I got a little bit of flack on that online for saying, what lessons can you learn in a preseason game? But I think that's exactly it, Liz, is that, you know, if anything, Connor walked away with this knowing that he can trust, at least to a certain extent. I mean, it's still preseason, so like players are still protecting themselves, working on their fitness. But if maybe the scoreline doesn't say something attractive to the point that we scored goals, it certainly highlights that whatever that back line defensively, we were able to maintain a clean sheet against a team that, for all intent, Hartford looks like it means business this season, especially with its signings. Like, they're punching up in weight to be a USL1 team. I think this makes sense. So a final question before I move on, does this basically look like a preview of a future Jägermeister Cup match, or do you think there's going to be more to learn?
I think that it could very well be that preview for the Jägermeister Cup that they've introduced this season. I know Portland has a few familiar faces that they've signed, a couple guys, Revs too, a defender. Was it Messier from us, I believe?
Nate Messier, yep.
So I believe they're building a solid kind of foundation out there with their guys. And like I said, one game early, you know, testing things out. But I think going forward in the game that'll actually matter, they'll take whatever they needed to learn from this matchup and polish it, like fix up whatever, iron out whatever bumps they need to.
Yeah. And you know, also too, when you look at the team itself, there's trialists with this team right now. There's a photo that we have here on the video feed of everyone that's currently there with Rhode Island FC. We know that there's as many as 5 trialists. There could be more because some of the players that may be, you know, on the men that are there but didn't particularly, you know, drive to wherever this photo was taken, could be on site. You know, we've heard rumors that there's a signing. I keep hearing a particular name. I don't know what that person looks like, so I can't say if they're in this photo or not. But, you know, we heard the same thing last year with that other Revs Academy player, Alex Sterenberg or something. I never say his last name right. But we were told he was signing as he was spending time out in Bermuda. So until we hear something, we don't ever kind of want to say what we don't know. But I will say that Leo, once again from the Discord, capital J journalism, recognizing what looks like Kevin Castaneda from URI down in that picture. I agree. He looks strikingly like Castaneda. So I think that's most likely him. It would make sense being a Rhode Island player. But I also actually recognized a player and I'm super proud of myself. So I'm going to give myself a little pat on the back because it is rare when I'm able to do this. I kind of think in the back, that looks like Rio Hope Goon from, he's a defender from New York City FC and FC2. It would kind of make sense. I checked where he was at in his playing career. He's out of contract with NYCFC. He would come along the same pedigree as Stephen Turnbull. The club is not confirmed. I haven't even asked the club this week because they're out in Bermuda and I know I'm not going to get any answers. I could be wrong, but I kind of think that's him. So if you want to go look up that player and then tell me if you think I may have that right. Nevertheless, this is still preseason. These things don't matter. As long as they're learning the lessons, they're building the chemistry, like Liz said, that's all you can ask for. Any other thoughts on the Hearts of Pine other than we're going to see them in a big game in Tidewater? The guys from the Howlers are going to come out and collaborate with us. We may have to do Jaeger shots if the game goes to penalties. So I'm scared. Liz, are you going to do Jaeger shots with us if the game goes to penalties?
To be determined. I was like, I think I did one once a few years ago. It still haunts me sometimes.
I don't know why people drink that drink, but you know, hey, it's sponsoring our league, so I got to be careful what I say. So let's move into the final part before we get into this recap. This is a long pod, guys. Bermuda game just wrapped up. We have the results to kind of take things back. Last year, remember, Rhode Island FC played the Bermuda Select team on 2 separate occasions, first besting them 8-0 and then again 5-1. So that was a 13-1 total combination. And that was a team at the time that was only 30 days in existence, maybe less. So 13-1, what? You can't, that's perfect, right?
Yeah. I mean, so
that's a Miami scoreline.
Do you expect at this point, because there's a lot more, you know, like history with this team, that they're like putting up double digits? But I don't know. It's also his hometown. You think that they would be respectful, right? It's kind of a balance there. You don't want to embarrass someone.
I mean, I don't think there's embarrassment because like it's a professional club playing a national, like I honestly would expect, depending on the grade or the level of player, I would expect a team that plays in and out every single week to kind of be intrinsically a little bit more adjusted than a team of the best versions absolutely. Of everyone who play once every quarter, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what was it? What was the player at the U.S. Men's National Camp who was like, I actually had to practice for more than 3 hours for the first time in 5 years, and I never have to normally do that? I have the score line from the game. We're live. I don't know if it got leaked out, so we're just going to leak it here. And I can give you some of the breakdown in case that didn't go out in the actual game. So the Rhode Island FC did win against the Select team 6-0. And I can break down some of the stuff that happened in that time. So it was actually 0-0 at halftime. And we don't know the starters yet. I imagine maybe Kano brought in some of the final trialists, maybe some of the players who were looking to like really showcase what they could do ahead of coming back to the States. But it was 0-0 up to the 60th minute when Rhode Island made 8 substitutions. So we saw some of the team get 60 minutes of match fitness. I assume like Noah Fusson played all 90 minutes because that's what he does. But after that, it was just kind of off to the races. It looked like Jojea Quizera scored. Noah Fusson then scored a couple minutes later. Taimu Okiyoshi then scored. Noah Fusson got a brace. And then Noah Fusson gets the hat trick in the 87th minute before Taimu Okiyoshi scores his brace of the night. So, I mean, that's you love to see it. We'll do a little bit more of a write-up if we have time, you know, post this podcast. But you expect to see these kinds of results. And I think they treated it with respect, but, like, you expected them to win by a considerable margin, right?
Yeah, 6-0 is simultaneously a thrashing, but also not like something where they have to, like, you know, go home and cry about it, because at the end of the day, it's you realize as a player that there's a gap there. These players are playing with each other in a league constantly where, like you had mentioned, the Bermuda Select only gets together every so often to play these games.
Right. Liz, any final takeaways on the Bermuda camp? Is this something that more clubs in New England need, like the Revolution need to be a part of it? Hartford, like, I want to see a Bermuda Invitational, like the Coachella Invitational, like the Florida camps. I want to see us start something in Bermuda so that fans can then go out, watch these games, do a little vacationing. Would you go to Bermuda to watch soccer? Let's break that question down.
Absolutely. I have a whole bucket list of all the places I'd love to go to watch a game. I'll add that right on there.
She's like, Matt, stop asking dumb questions. I love it. I respect it. Listen, we'll see what happens. We'll unpack what's to come in the next 2 weeks from the club. There is only one official preseason match left on March 8th, next Saturday. I can tell you through random fact-finding that allegedly it will be the Revolution 2. A friend of a friend who talked to a person within the Revs system said that it will be them. I can't say it for sure, but I will try to get that vetted by one of the two clubs. But most likely it's looking like it will be the Revolution 2. And if not, I'll, you know, pull that back, or I'll get it confirmed in the next week here. So are you guys ready to finally get into why we came together to do a podcast today? We're only 52 minutes in, so we've got about less than 30 minutes, I'd say, before people start to go, this is going too long. But are we ready? Are we ready to do this?
Let's do it.
All right. So what I wanted to talk about today was just, again, going over the recap of 2024 and then getting us all the way to where we are here now in 2025. I think this should be pretty standard. I don't think there's going to be anything that surprises the diehard fan, but I do kind of look at this as something where, when you take a look at how things go from the perspective of kind of getting us from where we are to where we're going, it matters in that sense. So where did Rhode Island FC end their season last year? Well, on a 12-15-7 record. We all know that the draw Kings was one of the biggest storylines of 2024. They scored 56 goals, 41 goals against, with a plus 15 goal differential. Their home record was 7-8-2. Their away record, perfectly balanced, 5-7-5. Their biggest win of the season was the kickstart of their kind of trajectory into getting as close as they did, with their 5-2 win away at Lou City. Their biggest loss of the season, also away at Tampa Bay, right at the beginning of the season. They won the Eastern Conference Championship. And of course, they lost 3-0 to Colo Spigs in the USL Cup final. Jason, I want to ask a question here for this goal differential. You know, when you take away the Miami result, was what this team had considered positive results? Because I take away the 8 goals. Let's say they only smashed them 2-1. You take away 6 goals, that puts them middle of the pack. But right now with this goal differential, that put them third highest in the league, and that put them higher than every single team in the West. Was this team better than that production, or is that number skewed by one single game?
I mean, considering that amount brought them to third, I feel like that means they were kind of there or about in that pack. And then we also look back early in the season where there's kind of goals that should have been happening that were not. So I look at it as almost like a balance of the mean, where you've got a drought towards the end and you've got a surplus at the end to kind of, it kind of balances out. So I would say that maybe take a few off of there, but ultimately I think that's about right. When we look forward to the next season, you know, maybe the expectations might be different, but ultimately I think that's a good amount there.
Liz, next question. Can we consider Burns Stadium? Was that a fortress for us? Only two losses on the season. I know there was a lot of unfavorable or quote unquote boring moments with several nil-nil performances. If we didn't have those eight draws, we wouldn't have gotten where we did into the playoff standing. Is this an impressive result? Should we respect that there were only two losses in front of home fans on the first season?
Yeah, I definitely think, like you said, for it being the first season, it also being a temporary stadium, like not an ideal, I think, kind of environment for some people. Only losing two games over, like two home games over the course of the season, I think is extremely impressive for a first-year team. And like you said, there may have been some more boring moments or results, but I also was right there for all the exciting ones. Like there was a lot of, I think like last minute, I'm thinking specifically, I can't remember the opponent, but it was stoppage time. Isaac Anking drills the game-tying goal at the death, and the crowd just, the stadium just kind of exploded.
That was the July 5th Indy 11 game.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, I can't remember who exactly, but I just remember the feeling of watching the ball cross the line and everyone losing their minds. Losing only two games was great for a first year.
Now that's being said from someone with a high soccer IQ, for the casual fan, do we think that they walked away from that first year of was Burns soccer exciting at the whole? Because I agree, I think two losses is a phenomenal result, and you know, sure, those eight draws could have been converted one direction or another, but we got the results where we needed it, whether we knew it or not. But do you think the casual fan who is dipping their toe into USL, you know, Division II soccer, do you think they were entertained with that product? Remembering Kano always made the commitment he would never offer a win, but he would try to make it as entertaining as possible. Do you think he lived through on that commitment?
I would have to say, yeah, I think he did. Because while there may have been a few like underwhelming games, I can think of several where I walked away from that stadium or game just, you know, thrilled, like the adrenaline going. Even if it might have been a tie, it was probably one of the most exciting ends to a game in a while.
That's the soccer sicko in all of us. Jason, next question. Our goals against placed us in eighth in the Eastern Conference. I didn't do the Western track because that puts us below the average in the table. Defensively, does this meet the expectations for Kano in year one? Or was this because we always clawed back and got a result that we kind of can dismiss it out of turn as a hard-fought battle? Do we get kudos for being an expansion team, or are there answers that need to be solved for the defensive side of this? Keep in mind, you know, you see again, 41 goals against, the best in the standard for the league was, of course, Bob Lilly and Lilly Ball with the Pittsburgh Riverhounds at like, I think, 23. So is there work to be done here? Or as long as it's like you win and you outscore, that's all that matters.
When I think about that, I'm not too concerned, especially in the sense of we got ourselves into a good position still. I think if we were leaking too many goals and also kind of had a, you know, just missed the playoffs or maybe got knocked out the first round, then you'd say, okay, maybe we need to kind of tighten the screws here a little bit. But ultimately, like, as much as I can enjoy like peak Jose or, you know, like they've changed their style a bit, but some like, you know, some really solid, dirty Atletico Madrid that they were known for a good period of years, just that defensive masterclass, that can be fun in itself. Maybe if you find yourself in a position where, you know, everyone is jumping on board with the team, but we are a brand new expansion team. We want to get a bunch of people who maybe are not soccer sickos into this team. So we don't need peak Jose. We need something more exciting and expansive. And if that means we have to give up a few goals to score some goals, I'll take it. As long as at the end of the day, like I said, we're still there or about, we're in the playoffs, we're competing. We're not just missing the playoffs because we let in way too many goals this year.
Fair enough. Moving on to the 2024 contributors. This was a bit surprising when I brought these totals together. Again, the playoffs just kind of happened and things ran away, and there were some storylines I think that we buried that we didn't really talk about. So it's wild to see JJ at the top of the leaderboard, because going into the playoffs, you know, even if we remove Miami, 8 of those goals came from the last 5 games of the season, and he had been playing with us as early as like May 13th. So the fact that it took almost the entire season for JJ Williams to get his groove back, nothing short of incredible. You know, I think it's going to be one of the biggest storylines is, can he replicate that? Can he continue this finishing, this streak, if you will, into this next season? Also kind of a secret that got buried here. Chico entered the double digit territory very sneakily, scoring his goals in Miami. Again, you get caught up in the hype of that 8-1 crushing defeat against Miami. And then, you know, he scores the goal against Lou City, puts him into 11 goals. Kind of a surprising thing. He goes from goal 2023 Golden Boot winner, then hits double digits again. I really wasn't prepared for that, looking at this until he pulled those stats. And also, you have to think about it, he was kind of relegated to a super sub impact role in the tail end of the season as JJ found his footing. Is this something that we should expect to see more of? I didn't think his goals were going to be this high.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of also forgot that, oh yeah, he did kind of sneak there into double digits. And then, kind of speaking of being sneaky, if you look at Fusan's numbers there, you know, I just didn't realize, like, oh, he was one goal away from having a double-double there. 10 goals, 10 assists. I mean, that is very impressive. I mean, he's also got the fastest goal in club history so far. I mean, very impressive. I knew that.
Well, I mean, Noah would have gotten the double-double if he had converted that penalty against Lou City.
Yeah.
Which, now that I think about it, because remember, he missed 2. I couldn't think about at the time why he was being the designated kicker. Now it makes sense. Like, that was a stat padding opportunity to get to that.
Yeah, definitely. And then, I mean, also thinking about looking at some of these other contributors here, we look at how important Jojay Aquizera was and those good numbers, but then you realize right behind him, super sub Mr. Joe Brito right behind him, especially when we felt earlier on in the season, maybe he was kind of playing out of position and not really doing as much for the team as we thought he could have. I think ultimately it turns out that that was more of a symptom of the entire team itself. And then once we got our groove, and then he kind of started to slot in there in those last 30 minutes, and he'd come up big there and get some assists and goals for us.
Liz, Jojo was one of the highest rated players on the season, at least by the metrics that Opta puts out. When you look at the gap between Jojo Aquizera and Joe Brito, knowing that Brito played at best half of the minutes in terms of output, was Joe Brito, does he deserve more respect on the Brito brand, or did Jojea not do enough then to let a super sub impact catch him if he was one of the best players on the pitch?
So I think one of the biggest things for me that I can recall from the past season with Jojea was, I think he hit like a really good stride around when he was called up for his national team. I know he went off with them for a bit, came back and was in like a pretty good rhythm for us, which I think, looking historically at soccer players across all levels, whenever you get called into your national team, it's that nice little boost of your hard work being rewarded. And so you want to, you know, show off a little bit, just show that you deserve it. But kind of like you said, Brito did a great job this season as that like super sub role. His nail in the coffin against Hartford, I believe, was him.
He doesn't celebrate it too much. He doesn't celebrate it too much as a Hartford guy. He has to tone it down.
I just think like seeing him find that success on the pitch, in that super sub role, was great. Sorry, I'm like, but I'm just thinking like specifically with him. I remember before the game in Hartford, the traveling Rhode Island fans, we had that like kind of tailgate set up. Mm-hmm. And I remember a car pulling up and like a bunch of people getting out in all their different burrito jerseys of his family. So it's nice that he has his little like crew behind him, little support group of his own.
Of the families, do you think he has the biggest traveling support? There was quite a bit from the Burrito family.
It's got to be Burrito, Fusan, or Holstead. It's one of the three of them, because I've seen a lot of the Holstead family. I know that the Fusan family travels out for the big games. We saw a lot of the Alves clan too, but at least on his wife's side. So, but I'd say active player, it's got to be Joe Burrito all the way. Joe Burrito knows where the bodies are hidden. Okay. And if that Joe Burrito doesn't know, the Joe Burrito that applied for a job at the Tidewater, did you guys see that video that WPRI out?
Oh, okay. I thought he like got stuck behind the line or something, just trying to get into the office.
So for those of you that are like listening, going, what are you guys talking about? The news put out an interview just asking random people applying for jobs at Tidewater, and they interviewed Joseph Burrito for a job, and he was like, I don't know, I think I'll get into like ticketing maybe or security, and I think that Joseph Burrito, I mean, looked nothing like him, so you have to go watch the interview. But there, did you think Joe Burrito knows that Joe Burrito plays for Rhode Island FC? And do you think Joe Burrito the player knows that Joe Burrito works at the soccer club?
This is a Joe Burrito-ception.
Joe Burrito-ception.
I'm lost.
But listen, Liz, I think that's spot on. It's, you know, and you look at other players like Zach Haravo wasn't initially a starter. He had to earn his way into that. He had a record season for himself in his career. Isaac Anking, before he got hurt, was on a trajectory to shatter every single person's record on this sheet that we see. So I think we'll ask a question here in the minutes to come about the storyline around this, but you love to see this. The only sad part here, Stephen Turnbull on the top contributors and now gone. It'll be interesting to see Darcy had some of the best numbers, you know, fourth in positioning for contribution, but will that number increase if he goes to a right wing back capacity, or will that diminish? Will Danny Rivera be asked to put in some time and get that? Like, how does that shake out? It'll be interesting nevertheless. Speaking of losses, I can't think of a better transition than to talk about the players now out from Rhode Island FC. Mark Doyle, Prince Sadie very early in the season, but we added him. Connor McGlynn, Gabriel Alves, Nate Messer, Colin Smith, and Nate Silvera. Like we said earlier, all of these players now in USL One teams or USL Championship in the case of Colin Smith, the only one on this roster, Nate Silvera, who has now retired from league play. He's got to come back for a game. We got to honor. He needs to be at the first game, and like they need to pan to him, like, you know, East Providence legend Nate Silvera. I hope he's there. Any thoughts before we move into this? Is there anything that kind of strikes you out? You know, I know we were talking about it sucks to see these players leave, but at the same time, it's a matter of business. Any surprises here?
No, I think being the first season here, we might look back on some of these players with rose-colored glasses, so to say. And that doesn't mean that I don't think these players don't have quality. It's just if we're being honest with ourselves, no one outside of Doyle here really had any meaningful minutes for this team. A lot of them were kind of in and out of the side. Some of them very, like, you know, like Nate Messer, like double-digit minutes at best, right? Like he really didn't play a lot for this team. So I think they're clearly some good players. They just didn't fit for the system. They'll be a part of that legendary first year, but you know, I wish them all the best and hope that they do well in their new clubs, as long as it's not against us.
I mean, you talk about kind of not making a incredible impact. I already forgot a player that I didn't even put on the slide in Kofi Tchimessi. So I think you're spot on. Like,
that was a very recent move, though.
They're too, in and out. They're fringe players. I mean, they all helped contribute to a team that went on to win the Eastern Conference Championship. But to that same point and same extent, like, that was done in practice sessions. We know Mark Doyle was a beast in training. We know that Kevin Vang like left it all out in the field. Of course, he's still with the team. Liz, is there any player that we're really going to miss that you know, we should have held on to, we should have done more to fight for?
I think I have to agree that most of these players kind of at some point fell out of wherever they had been. I know a big one for me was I really liked Alves at the beginning. Alves, sorry. but it just like stinks when you have a player who gets injured and then you bring in other guys to kind of fill those gaps and then you fall out of favor. Like, it's one of the bittersweet parts of like any sport, I think, because at the end of the day, it is just another business and tough decisions have to be made.
I would be a terrible teammate. I'd be so toxic knowing that like Jason took my spot and I would just be like plotting and like I couldn't do it. Anyone that's in sports at a professional level, I have no idea how you cope if you're not exactly where you want to be. Like if I knew I wasn't good enough and like I was always relegated to a supporting role, I would live in that space. I would love it. But if someone told me I was the best and then someone else came along and I had to, I don't know how I could be Gabby Alves on Rhode Island FC last season. So anyways, moving along, getting into the final piece here on the outs. Now the ins on our transfer ins. That is the wrong slide. Let's try that again. Did I not load the transfer in? I'm all over the place, guys.
There you go.
There we go. On the transfer ins, we have, of course, Maxi Rodriguez, Taimu Okiyoshi, Ugo Bacharach, Danny Rivera, Alder Sanchez, Cole Dewhurst, and goalkeeper Will Meyer. At least for now, those are the ones. So I want to ask you guys, Liz, we'll start with you. One, are these players upgrades? I mean, is it a fair question to ask? Have we brought in the depth that is like for like and we're upgrading in these spots? Or should we we won't know, of course, until the season plays out, but you know, should we have held on to some of the talent that we lost? Are these positions that make us better, or is it a gamble on a year two project?
I think looking at this list of the players that we've brought in, obviously the first one that really sticks out to me is Maxi Rodriguez. I remember watching our games against Detroit and knowing that he was a pain in our side. He was a really talented player and I hated every minute we were playing against him. And following like their news of when he left, like seeing him leave, I never would have guessed personally that he was going to be coming to Rhode Island. But I will say, getting that notification on Twitter, I was so excited to see what he can do on my team instead of against my team.
If you can't beat him, if you can't let him join you, exactly. Jason, question for you. You know, I think of the big storyline here in Ugo Bacharach stepping in now for the non-likeliness of Morris Duggan returning here to Rhode Island FC. Can Ugo be the guy? You know, we also have Stephen Turnbull now gone. Can Danny be the guy? Or is this going to be something that we may not have answers to until midway through the season?
I think it's definitely possible when we look at the additions. It's going to be hard to say, though, here. Ugo hasn't played for us yet. So, I mean, there's not even some preseason kind of things to get out of hand with. You know, I would like the idea personally of Danny Rivera kind of maybe being at that wing spot, but then it also leaves you in this predicament of like, well, we also have too many center backs and they can't all play. So it is a tough position to be in. I think that the people who have, you know, held down that fort at times who are not necessarily out and out wingbacks have done good jobs. But you also think some of those players maybe could do well in other positions. When we look at comparing the ins and outs compared to last year, you know, it seems to be an additional defender here or there compared to like forwards.
Still light on the forwards.
Yeah. And so I know that ultimately, like someone like Kevin Ordoy never, you know, really he suited up for us, but he never saw that.
You love to climb this Ordoy mountain. I love it.
Well, it's one of those kind of worst case scenario things where you plan for that. We have 10,000 midfielders, so you know, and Maxi Rodriguez can kind of be that second forward in a way. The concern there would be in terms of, can everyone stay healthy this year, right? Chico had a few, you know, spells being out. And then we started the year without JJ. You know, if we find ourselves in a position where we're missing one of those guys,
we call up Jack Panayotu.
I mean, maybe, I don't know, but do we have the depth there to, you know, make sure that we have enough people to play up forward? I mean, and maybe at this point, then maybe we see some adjustments in the way we play, in terms of the way we attack, to kind of make up for that. it's kind of early to say. We'll kind of have to wait and see what Coach Kano's got in store for us.
I think if everyone stays healthy, to your point, it's really a matter of time to wait until Isaac Engkin can come back. And I mean, you know, he played in that high attacking midfielder role, but he can be a striker. There's no doubt in my mind he cannot be a super sub impact kind of game changer. So if I was Kano, unless the right person comes across the system and it's just good business, I think that our attacking line is our attacking line for the time being. I also want to say, though, you know, we didn't see Jackson Lee in any of the footage from the Bermuda so far, but we also didn't really see much of him from the IMG Academy either. I don't have a timeline. I probably won't find that out till the week prior to the first game, but you know, he's definitely still on the mend from that injury in Kolo Spiggs. I wouldn't be surprised if Will Meyer is suddenly the backup for Koke Vegas in the first few games of the season. Like, we may need to rely on this new goalkeeper very quickly in some alternate, you know, capacity. So that's exciting to see. But I want to move on and start to kind of touch in on the storylines that we have for the season. So, you know, lots of questions here. And so we tried to pick some of the biggest ones that we wanted to like really hammer into. And so starting off here, 6-game away leg to start the season, 5 regular games, as well as 1 game in the Jägermeister Cup. The schedule here on the board for people watching, you know, we've got that first game against Charleston Battery away. These are all away. And then Phoenix Rising, Loudoun United, Oakland Roots, and then our favorites, Detroit City, Maxi Rodriguez less Detroit City FC, before the first Jägermeister Cup match at Westchester SC. Guys, I want to ask, you know, when you look at this, this is going to be a daunting task. Coach Kano has already said, I'm going to take this one game at a time. I can't even begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, coming May 3rd. Is this the best lineup we could ask for from an away circuit? Obviously, it's not great to have to go immediately back to Charleston and kind of like settle bets, if you will, you know, let sleeping dogs lie. But then we have Phoenix Rising, which is under reconstruction, brand new coach. Loudoun United, nobody ever knows. Like, they can be great, they can be bad. Oakland Roots just hit the implode button and sold all of their valuable attacking pieces with Johnny Rodriguez now at the lights. Detroit City, they don't have Maxi. I haven't seen them make really any kind of aggressive attacking signing options. I don't want to put my own rose-colored glasses on, Jason, like you mentioned a minute ago, but is this the best possible first few? I mean, Charleston's going to be the toughest test, but outside of that, like, could we ask for a better kind of start to the season?
I mean, best possible, no, but I also think that, you know, in terms of our stairway to Tidewater, that it could be worse, right? We, you know, it could be, you know, Charleston right into Lou, you know, into Indy, into Pittsburgh. Like, it could be a lot worse. I think there are a few games here where we think, okay, you know, like you said, what is Loudoun? I don't know. No, I don't think anyone knows. Oakland Roots, like you said, they gave us a tough match last year, but also they lost a lot of attacking players. You know, can Detroit City score goals without Maxi Rodriguez? That is yet to be seen. So I think this is decent. It's not easy, but it's not the most difficult.
Liz, what's the significant impact of having to play 6 straight games on the road, from just the travel, from the mental fatigue? I mean, you were a player. What is it like when you had to play that many games back to back without the benefit of being in your home stadium, your home turf?
So a stretch like that definitely will wear on you more towards the middle of it, in my opinion. Like you said, first game against Charleston, probably going to be the toughest of the 6. So it's nice to get that one out of the way early. But I also think, on the other hand, just knowing that you have your new stadium to look forward to and all the fans are going to be there to celebrate your accomplishments from the previous season will be that little extra motivational push, I think, to keep a high confidence and high just boost going into it, just knowing that you have all that, like, a lot of good to look forward to, I guess.
I think Charleston can be somewhat of a trap game. Maybe we did play them, I think it was the 3rd or 4th game of last season, where they didn't really know us. They came, it was the worst weather game of the season last year, was the Charleston game. And so this could be more of the same, as both these teams are shaking out the rust. Charleston will be coming off of a game previously the week before against Lou City. We'll talk about their opponents here in a second. But I think, Liz, you're right. There's a lot of mileage that has to be kind of taken place between where this club is traveling. It's not all East Coast. You're going all the way to Arizona, then you're back, then you're going to DC, but then you're going all the way back out to Northern California. So there's definitely, this is going to wear and tear. I think the opponents are as good as you could ask for. And, you know, when you look at that from a standpoint of what we kind of believe will be the teams that are all fighting for the positions 1 through 4, on the screen we have all of the different clubs who will be in that contention for a home playoff spot, as it's believed by the pundits. And you're right. Like, look at Lou City. They have to go against Charleston away, Birmingham away, which Birmingham is either going to be the sleeper pick or just they're going to fall off the rails. Then they have Detroit. Then they have Sacramento Republic. Then they have the Rowdies. I think Lou City has the worst. Then Charleston, they get us. They get Lou. They get Tampa. They get Indy 11 and Pittsburgh. That's no better. Birmingham gets Lou, gets Detroit, gets Pittsburgh. And then they get gifted some freebies with El Paso, Locomotive, and Hartford. And then Pittsburgh themselves, they get, again, I think some freebies around the place. They're North Carolina. No one really knows what they're going to look like yet.
The USL show guys are kind of high on them.
Yeah, so but they were high last season on them. Yeah. And
we'll see.
San Antonio, they're a work in progress with a new coach. Then they get Hartford. Then they start to get a little harder. So, I think the big three, if we're included in that, I think we have the easiest schedule of all of these groups. I would not want to be Birmingham. I would not want to be Charleston. I would not want to be Lou City at the beginning of this first 6-game leg. I guess the question to finalize on this with these storylines, though, is if we have bad results, how important is it to not dig ourselves into a hole so early in the season? Or is that just fate, and if it happens, it happens, and we move on because it's 6 games on the road?
I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, we've hammered this home for a while. And like Liz said, you just have to take it one game at a time.
I'm not asking one game at a time. I'm asking you're on the other side of that 6-game stretch.
Oh,
and you've lost every single game. Is it pack it up? We had a good run. We'll see. We'll try again in 2026, or do we dig out? Do we get the shovels out and do we dig?
I think if we look at this team, that they have a real good grit and determination. So in the unlikely event that they find themselves in a hole that big, you know, I have faith that they will fight their way out of it. So I wouldn't be too concerned. And then especially going forward there, you have a potential fortress at home, assuming that they don't kind of let the nerves get to them and think, oh, you know, like, are we worried about the expectations of the event? I mean, they've already played in front of the fans. It's just the stadium that's changed. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
Liz, any final thoughts?
No, I think I agree with the way we saw this team crawl back for results some games last year. I don't think I would fully count them down and out if they get a couple of rough results at the beginning of the season. I think they could definitely dig themselves out of a hole.
Never say die, guys. Never say die. Moving on to the next one, Tidewater Landing officially opening. This one hits on a double-pronged approach here when you think about it, right? Because it's the performance side of it, right? It's taking keys, it's taking ownership of your new place, your new home, your new fortress, and trying to do exactly that. Obviously, there are going to be a lot of teams that understand who Rhode Island FC is in year two. They may have come into the league a little bit of an unknown factor. They kind of, especially the Eastern Conference teams, it took them a couple of lessons to learn how to manage against Rhode Island FC. Lou City never figured it out. So there's some questions that may have been answered. You know, the thing that I think of more specifically with Tidewater, though, is the community optics side of it, right? Like, we're fighting the battle of getting people into the stadium, making them fall in love with the sport the same way the three of us have. Does that put a burden on the players? Does that get in the way of their ability just to perform and play at Tidewater?
I don't think so. I think ultimately they know that they just need to go out there, do their best, follow, you know, coach's direction, and just kind of play their game. I think that ultimately they know to a certain extent, right, that they are maybe advertising that in a way, but I think most of them, especially, these are professional athletes, right? They, at the end of the day, that's not their concern. Maybe they're thinking about that outside of the pitch, but during the game, they're like, all right, I'm tasked with marking this guy, or I need to attack this space. And like,
Renato Adames is running at me right now. I need to do something about it.
Yeah. They've got too much else on their mind to worry about, you know, whether or not the club has attracted enough new fans. I think that the front office and maybe some of, you know, the regular outside of like work activities where they're not, you know, being a professional athlete, maybe they can kind of help out with that. But at the end of the day, they're a soccer player. They just need to go out there and do their, you know, do a soccer, as they say, you know.
Liz, question for you. This team, now the USL runners up, 80% of this team continues on to play for a second season. Not something that's very common in the USL Championship, especially in an expansion year. A lot of these teams get blown up. They learn what worked, what didn't work. I think this is only the third team in the history of the modern era for USL where a majority of the players stay on. And like, I think the most recent example is Monterey Bay, who haven't made the playoffs ever, I think. And I'm not throwing shade. I think that's a legitimate statement. Question for you. Now that everyone knows what this team is capable of, were there games last season that, you know, Rhode Island FC didn't get taken as serious as an opponent as they should have been? And are clubs going to be out to prove themselves against the runners up?
So one that you kind of already hinted at, I think we will definitely have a bigger target on our back this season against Louisville. I think we were the first team to hold them without a goal. That's right. Okay. I was like, I couldn't remember exactly. First team
without a goal, and they didn't make the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yes. So I think that's one to look out for, that I think we'll definitely have a larger target on our back. There's another game. I can't exactly remember who we played against, but it was one where it definitely felt like they were playing for a tie. And I'm trying to remember who it was, because it was a home game at Burn. And I remember Oakland. Their goalie. There's a whole thing with the keeper.
Oakland.
Yes, yeah.
That's who I thought, but I wasn't positive. That one was definitely felt like they didn't really want to push it too much. Like they were hoping to end that game in a draw. But I definitely think there are a few teams in the league that weren't expecting a team that Rhode Island put out, like successful, how they were going to play. So I think we'll definitely have more eyes on us after finishing as runners up in the league.
Jason, next question to you. How does RFC prioritize all of its competitions? We now have Open Cup, which Kano will probably want to at least get past the first round. Now there's this Jägermeister Cup, which can have hardware involved. You know, we have the depth, it feels like, because there's conversations about who starts when, where, and how. Is this team now suited properly to make deep runs into all of these different competitions? Or will we most likely see Rhode Island FC prioritize a single one or two of the three?
I mean, I think you kind of touched upon it in the question itself there, right? The depth. So did we go out and sign the right players to make improvements on the ones that we've lost? So can we have a rotated side where we maybe change five or six of our starting 11, bring in some guys like Taimi Okiyoshi, you know, and feel comfortable that we are going to put out a competitive product? I think that would be the key there in terms of managing minutes where we're having midweek games because of the Jägermeister Cup being on Saturdays on top of, you know, Open Cup is always midweek as well. So really being able to manage those players, keep them healthy, and find that right balance of who can I drop and switch out and only see like marginal decreases, maybe where we feel comfortable that, hey, this is a good product I put out in the field. I'm confident in this, that we can at least keep it tight, where you can then always have that option of like, hey, it's 0-0. We've got 20, 30 minutes left. Let's bring on the quote unquote big guns and sub in someone like JJ or Quisera or someone you're giving the night off to give them some rest and maybe kind of put the game to bed, as they say.
So would you say that we would poke and see how far we can get into each of them and never not take it serious, but keep the regular season in our crosshairs?
Yeah, the regular season always has to be the main priority. So that's why in a lot of these side competitions, you would say, you're going to want to kind of maybe do some rotation, but also there's a balance there too, right? If you say, well, I've got a midweek game that's a league match against a lesser opponent, maybe I can get away with some rotation and then actually field a stronger side for the Jägermeister Cup at the end of the week. So it'll be kind of a game by game thing, but ultimately rotation and balance of the team is going to be the key there to kind of trying to at least fight for these competitions.
Liz, you've seen firsthand what, you know, player competition, player rotation can do to a locker room. Obviously, the wealth of talent helps this team for these types of deep extended runs if we're afforded the chance. But overall, does that leave questions on who the starting 11 is, or do we think that Kano will find who his guys are and see a pretty consistent lineup independent of maybe the Open Cup or Jägermeister Cup rosters that we see game to game?
So I think it'll be kind of like a little bit of balance of that. I know personally firsthand on certain teams, you will have like your main 11 that you can rely on for the main, like probably most important competition. In this case, we're talking regular season. But there'll also be those players that, you know, kind of like a super sub, you know, that you can pick and rotate and have them step up in the moments of like the US Open Cup or this Jägermeister Cup, which I think is important. Like as a player myself, I was also always told it's about flexibility and being ready wherever your coach needs you, no matter what it might be, how uncomfortable you might think it is, just always be ready to go. So I think as long as we have players who are willing to, you know, be flexible and do what benefits the team the best, we'll be in good hands. And I think Kano, you know, knows these guys. These guys seem to love playing for this team. So I think once we figure out how we can move these pieces around, we'll be set for regular season and beyond.
If you had to prioritize the Open Cup or the Jägermeister Cup, which would you prioritize?
For me personally, I think the Open Cup.
There's a part of me that, you know, loves the history of that competition. But then there's also the reality of, like, you know, most of the time MLS teams are going to come for your lunch money. So I would almost think maybe with the Jägermeister Cup, you have a more, you know, a higher percentage chance of actually winning that, right?
Right.
Especially considering that we made it to the finals last year.
Agreed.
So I don't think there's any team except for, you know, maybe Colo Spigs, who kind of keeps us up at night.
And I mean, there's no guarantee that they'll figure that out again, right? Those are two games at altitude at Widener Field. We won't be playing them again this season. You know, I think that's the question that we'll have to ask for maybe the next episode of have teams figured out, like, did they get the blueprint from both of those Colo Spigs games? Do they just have to emulate what the Switchbacks did, or was the home field advantage truly something that set the team apart? It's questions to answer, but I think kind of wrapping things up here, this is the projection that Jason and I have for what we think will most likely be the end result for the table. Last week we shared what the USL show guys had kind of thrown out there. I think this feels right. We've got Louisville in first, Charleston in second, Rhode Island FC in third, Pittsburgh Riverhounds in fourth, and Birmingham Legion in fifth. But I want to be honest, positions three through five feel really interchangeable at this point. And then you've got position six with the Rowdies, seven Indy 11, eight Detroit City FC, and then rounding out the pack outside of the playoff hunt, North Carolina FC, Loudoun United, Hartford Athletic, and Miami FC. I still don't think Miami's got enough in the tank to figure it out in the second year.
I wonder, though, if Loudoun is worse this year. But, I mean, maybe it's similar thing. Where
Loudoun's literally like a dark horse. It's on their badge.
10 through 12 could be kind of interchangeable there, too, where we know those teams are not going to do very well this year. It's just who's going to be the worst of the bunch.
Liz, any particular takes here that you think kind of stand out? Is there anything that we're not getting right based on what you've kind of been looking at from the musket side?
No, I think I'd say this seems pretty accurate for, I think, what's been going on in the, you know, between what we saw last season and all the off-season moves this year. I'd say it's pretty likely, I think, for how we could see the conference play out this season.
Do you think Hartford has any chance of actually making the playoffs? And you, it's okay. You can say what you think. You won't get flamed too hard for it.
Honestly, I don't think they're quite there yet. I know recently they had a preseason match against the Revs up at Gillette, which didn't seem like anything too crazy from what we saw. So I think they're not quite playoffs yet still.
Agreed. They'll never be playoffs. And by the time they can, it's because we've left the league, moving to Division One, and blaze the path forward for them. So I think, Jason, I think that's going to wrap it. We've got some other predictions we can share in the weeks to come. But this has been a fantastic show, a long show, but they're always long when we have great guests like Liz on. Any final thoughts?
No, do we want to give Liz here the opportunity maybe to talk about where people can find her and check out her work?
I mean, Liz is always going to get the last moments of the show, but I want to make sure you had said everything that you needed to say. So if you're clear and free, Liz,
I'm good to go, homie.
Liz, what are your final thoughts? Where can people find you and your awesome work?
So my work can mainly be found on The Blazing Musket. I write most anything for this team. And every once in a while, I'll put my, you know, soccer thoughts out on Twitter. Username is going to be LizMcGowan_14. Mostly my ramblings during games, but all the same.
Are you on Blue Sky yet?
Not yet.
Got to make the jump. All the cool kids are doing it, or so I'm told. We're not cool, but we did it anyways.
At least in terms of like the soccer community, a lot of them have migrated over there. So it's good to keep up with them.
Awesome. Well, we'll see you in the box for this season ahead, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to make sure you come to all the scrums, so it's not always just Jason and I peppering Connor with questions. So we'll make sure that we trick you into always making sure you stop by there on your way out. But we appreciate everything you do, all of your excellent writing with the Musket, and just all the contributions you make to this community, both inside and out. Thank you so much for the time, and really appreciate you having you on.
Thank you guys again for having me. It was so much fun. Hope to come back again.
Absolutely. Awesome.
Yeah, thanks, Liz, for stopping by. And so make sure to check out our friends over at the Blazing Musket for all of your New England soccer coverage. And Blue Sky at RFC Podcast. We've got an Instagram at Raising Anchor, and there's that website, RaisingAnchorPodcast.com. Anchor's up.
Anchor's up, guys.